everyone. Welcome to the 75th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. I ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. And then please, a moment of silence for the ones that are still suffering in and out of the program. And with that, I'd like to introduce my first speaker. Okay, her name is Lorna Kelly.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Lorna, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. And I'd like to talk about something very important straight off. How do I look? Well, that's very good. The reason I'm sitting down, actually, let's get that out of the way, is that I have a defibrillator in my chest to keep my heart going. And if I stand for too long, it fires. So you don't want to see this rocket going over the meeting room. So it's best that I sit down. And that way, also, you can see my pretty ankles. When I got the invitation to speak here, I was saying to my friend in New York, Susan S., who's in this room that I can't see at the moment, I said, what should I wear? And she said, well, Lorna, you know, you're a New Yorker, and it doesn't matter what those people in Texas wear, you wear black. Little did I know I'd be speaking in a room that has all the charm of a police precinct. Any defect in my dress or malfunction is certainly compensated by your bright, shining faces. And it's lovely to see you all, and I'm delighted to be here, and it truly is a great honor. And thank you, Debbie, for chairing the meeting. And our topic is freedom to choose. And I have lots to say on that topic. And, of course, I think anyone that's in the program any while would have experiences of this thing of freedom to choose. And don't expect this qualification to be, you know, sensible or anything. It'll be all over the place. But when I came into the program, it was told that one takes suggestions. Suggestions did not work for me. I needed to be told what to do. I couldn't be given a choice. I couldn't be told, you know, well, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? I was told, you know, meet me at such and such a meeting and then we're going here for coffee afterwards. And I was very dictated to. And I just heard someone speaking this morning and he said this similar thing. His sponsor said to him about, you know, when we have this relationship, I don't want you to give me feedback on my... on my suggestion to you. And I don't want you to come to me and tell me, you know, the pros and cons of that, of what I told you to do. And don't tell me what you think of me. Just do it. And that's what it has been for me too. I'm good. I'm very personally powerful. And so being personally powerful, I was able to surrender very, very fast. And I was able to do what I was told. I was so fed up with leading my own life when I came into the program that I was really happy that someone was willing to tell me what to do. And I brushed up against that again in my teens in sobriety. and it propelled me into Al-Anon in a very big way. I came to see that I was the significant other I was living with. And and I was sick to death of myself. Sick to death with doing the same old, same old, same old. And I needed to know how to change. And those Al-Anons, while... they certainly know the secret to that. They certainly know how to keep the focus on yourself and that whole thing of change. And so let's get back to this topic of choosing. This is a very poignant time of year for me because it was at this time in 1976 that I was belly flopping towards my bottom. And at this time, I was in London. I worked for Sotheby's, and I worked for Sotheby's in New York, and Sotheby's is a very old and established art auction house. And I worked in New York, but I was in London because my company was having a very SMART gathering at some very SMART hotel in London, and all the notables of my firm were there, plus heads of museums and people with great collections and Lord and Lady Duwar Diddy and all that sort of thing. And and at that dinner dance, I was all done up in a ball gown, and I was going, while they were dancing, I was going from table to table, emptying their glass into mine. And something told me that my behavior did not quite go with my outfit. But I couldn't kind of put it all together, do you know? But anyway, I came back to New York. I left London, and I came back to New York because it was America's bicentennial, and I expressly wanted to see those tall ships going up the Hudson. I wanted to be there for that. And, of course, my husband had walked out the door, and I thought it was the most fascinating thing he'd ever done, actually. I was desperately unhappy. I wanted to get him back, but I was going out with someone else, mind you, that I wanted to marry. The fact that this guy hadn't mentioned marriage or anything didn't seem to pose any problem. But I was very upset that this relationship with this other guy was going south, and it was just mucky, and you know. Oh, and let's face it, we're rarely going out with the cream of the crop at the end of our drinking. Probably for the first 5 years also. But anyway, that certainly is the case, my case. But I was waving my goodbye to my father. My father was standing at the garden gate waving goodbye to me. And as I went off to London Airport, and I was so caught up in self, 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 I could not be bothered to turn and say goodbye to my father. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And it was the last time I was to see him. And that memory fills me with regret. And fills me with regret, and it's very poignant to this topic of what I choose, how I choose. And, you know, if you're standing in front of me, talking to me, am I busy on my cell phone? What am I choosing to do in this moment that you're in front of me? Freedom to choose, I think we get a myriad of those opportunities in our lives in any given day. Will I give it just that extra little bit of time? Will I just, you know, if I were to die in this moment, you would be the most precious people in my life. And you are. And so if I can hold that, if I can contain that with me, and this whole thing, you know, the awareness of what I have been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think having an awareness of realizing the preciousness of the moment is born out of the awareness of realizing what I've been given. And I know it's difficult to maintain that all the time. It's just very difficult. But I always have this vision of myself that if I were to meet Jesus the week after the resurrection, I might say to him, well, hi, you know, what have you been doing lately? And he would say to me, well, you know, they strung me up on a cross last Friday, and then I died, and they put me in a tomb, but I rose again on Sunday, and I'm awake from the dead. And I'd say, yeah, but that was Sunday. What have you been doing lately? I have that same quality about myself. Do I have that thing of myself? Yeah. I know I'm sober, but what about my job? What about my career? What about my relationship? What about this? What about that? You know, the heat doesn't work in my apartment and it's freezing. And there's all sorts of things that pull me off this awareness of the magnitude of the gift I've been given. And so it translates into, you know, the choices that I'm continually making. And are my choices about shoring up this life that is not really that important? It is not that important. But the real, and not shoring up the really important things of my life. And, you know, when I came in, Glenn Kay wants me to mention this word. When I came in, I was festooned in jewelry. I had jewelry all over the place. And I always say I'm very glad that I came into the program before tattooing and piercing became popular, because I'm sure I would have had the Last Supper put on my chest or something like that. And I would not have been content with a darling little stud in my nose. You know, I would have had to have a dish in my lower lip. Something subtle like that. And I have no idea why I started telling this story about... they've had something to do with choosing, believe me. But I don't... Oh, yes. So I'm showing a little more of the pretty ankles than I wanted to. I tell sponsees and people in the program, you know, if you want something tattooed on you, have tattooed, I've changed my mind. I've changed my mind. I didn't know how to have a cup of coffee with you without giving you the keys to my apartment. I didn't know how to set something in motion and stop it. You know, I thought I had to go all the way. I've never, ever told this story before and in a public forum like this, and I don't know that it's appropriate for an international tape, but it... at least it's out there, and I'm almost 34 years sober, and I'm finally I'm finally able to get over the humiliation. This was one of my deepest fourth step stories, and I tell it to newcomers, because you know how we think that we know it all when we come in. And when I came in, I was the first woman art auctioneer in America. I had the ability to keep masses of figures in my head. I had a very high-powered, very complicated mental job, and I was very good at it, very good at pulling collections together, weeding out collections. I know what I'm doing. We are told not to have relationships in our first year. We are told it is best not to. So one weekend, I was 90 days sober. I'm having brunch with an old master painting dealer. I think actually he was a friend of Rembrandt's. He was very old. And he invited me back to his hotel after brunch. And of course, one thing led to the other. And while he is performing on top of me, I am thinking to myself, what on earth is that I'm feeling? And it was his floppy testicles against my upper thighs. And I see a lot of women covering their faces. They are... So that was my choice. And that's what I chose to do. I chose not to obey, but to do going on my own course. And there's nothing like sagging to send one screaming back to celibacy and one's sponsor. So, there, it's out there. It's... It's on an international tape, and now you can all say, well, she's a friend of Mother Teresa's, but let me tell you. How much longer do I have? You know, at any time during that event, I could have said, you know, I've changed my mind. I do not want to go to the hotel with you, or I want to put my clothes back on, or get off me, or, you know, but I could not do that. I could not change my mind. I didn't know how. And the thing that appealed to me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous was not that you were sober. I didn't understand being sober. I couldn't even see that I drank, let alone that I wanted to be sober. But you had these qualities I wanted. You had the ability to say no thank you, without explaining your entire lives. You had, and you seemed to be able to make choices. You know, and people say, there's this expression, I don't know if it's in your groups, but it's often, you hear it in our groups, people will say, we're doing the next right thing. The next right thing. How can you do the next right thing? All you can do is the next thing in front of, all I could do is the next thing in front of me, and the next thing, and the next thing, and hopefully my program is ingrained enough in my soul and my being and everything in me that I will automatically be steered to something that's correct and non-harmful. And to illustrate this, you know, doing the next right thing and leading a spiritual life, I really always want to say this. Choices in sobriety, a spiritual life is not necessarily a comfortable life. And I think we look at that thing of, well, if I'm uncomfortable, then I'm doing something wrong. If I'm not comfortable, it's not correct. If I feel awkward, it's not correct. Well, it's not true. You know, life is not a Hallmark card. And I often say that we can't necessarily know that something was incorrect just because we were angry or outrageous or something. I'm crazy about the stories of Jesus, and I know you can mention, we're in the Bible Belt, you can mention Jesus here, but mention Jesus in New York and clear the room. But I always love the story of him going into the temple and flinging all those people out and getting the whip and overturning tables and the doves and the goats and God knows what, a squawking all over the place. And I don't remember reading anywhere that he went back the next day and said, look, I'm awfully sorry. You know, my disciples were acting up and I was having a bit of a resentment. He didn't. And I would like to tell this. There's two stories I want to tell to end this. I'm so aware of time, but I was standing in line for communion once, and it was in the time when they were dipping the host in the chalice of wine. And as I got up to the priest, I whispered, "No wine, please, no wine." And he, in a very loud, radiating voice, said, "This is not wine, this is the blood of Jesus." And
And you know how we can't stand to be told off. In an equally as a radiating voice, I said, I don't care what it is, I don't want it. And so there I am at the foot of the altar in this spiritual movement moment, having a row with the priest. And he, you know, he shoves the wafer in my hand and goes on to the next person and is very irritated. And I go back to my pew with no holy thoughts whatsoever. And a few weeks later, this woman comes up to me at a meeting and she said, you know, Lorna, I have to tell you that I was standing about three people behind you in the line for communion a few weeks ago, and I heard your exchange with the priest, and I was saying to God, I saw that he was dipping the host in the wine, and I was saying to God, please help me, what do I do, what do I do? And she said, and I heard you have that exchange, and it gave me the courage to say something too. I said, oh, well, that's just wonderful that I had jeopardized my immortal soul for you, you know, so... So, you know, we're not always given to see the results of our choices. And we can't always know. We can't always know, is this the right? Is it wrong? We don't. We just have to act in courage and go forth. And, you know, I'm in a program where I have a third step. And that third step allows me to leap before I look. It allows me to not have to think, will I be all right? Is there enough money in the bank? Will I will I be liked? Whatever. I've been given a grace. I live by grace, and my grace is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can't always get in touch with God. I don't always love you. I don't always love sobriety. I'm not, you know, I'm fickle. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm crazy about this program. And, I'm all right still? Good. Everyone always wants me to tell this story because, well, I'm going to preamble it with another story that's happened. A few months ago, I fell off a horse and I broke both my wrists. And it was unbelievably painful. And I just got the casts off last week. And I made a decision while I was in this terrible pain that I would not get back on a horse again. And I love riding. And I look great in those outfits. It's been a big sacrifice. But while I was in this terrible pain, and my arms were in casts, and I had to have someone do everything for me, I made this decision not to ride again. And I got rid of all my riding accoutrements, all the books, the gear, the helmet, the great clothes, everything. I got rid of it. And when I came into the program, I got rid of the alcohol in the house and the stemware and the lamps made out of, you know, champagne bottles and anything, anything that represented booze, because I knew I'd waver. I knew my choice, the freedom to choose, I knew my choice would not stay strong. And sure enough, when I got these things off my wrists and my arms, I started thinking, oh, you know, I really should get back on a horse again. I really should. I mean, I'm lucky I'm not Christopher Reeves. You know, I really am. And it would be madness for me to get on a horse. But anyway, I wanted to say that. And the last story that people always want me to say is about an incident that happened with Mother Teresa. And people love to hear that Mother Teresa was crazy about Alcoholics Anonymous, crazy about it. She was so fascinated and always wanted to talk about AA and alcoholism. And many is the time I said to her, you know, you sure you don't have a problem? You're very interested. But she loved to be involved with me. You know, she came for a meeting with me in Calcutta, and once she was in New York, and we were in a motorcade going up Madison Avenue, and we had the outriders and the police sirens and things, and we pulled over so that I could go to my meeting at 84th Street and Madison Avenue. And she just loved all that. Anyway, one time she was extremely ill, and we thought she was going. And I dashed up to Calcutta to be with her, and to say goodbye, and I was taken to the hospital room, and here's mother lying in bed. She's propped up against her pillows, and there's myself and three other nuns in the room that are her sisters. Other nuns. I'm not a nun. They weren't there. But, good. Thank you. And a young Indian priest came in to say Mass, and they set the table up at the foot of the bed. And when it came time for communion, he came around the side of the bed, and Mother pushed herself up from her pillows, and he dipped the host in the chalice of wine and gave it to her. And Mother very reverentially took the communion. I'm next. And through my mind is going, not here. Please, not here. Don't let me have to make a fuss here. There's this saint in her 90 dying in bed next to me. Don't let me bring all the attention onto myself. Let me just pass it this once. There's no one in AA here. It's not drinking. It's the sacred blood of Christ. It's not wine. Just, Lorna, do not make a fuss. And in that nanosecond or so, all of you went before my eyes. All those that have come before me. Bill Wilson standing in that lobby in the Mayflower Hotel, choosing, will I go this way? Will I go that way? And talk about freedom to choose. In that moment, did heaven not hold its breath? Did heaven force itself on Bill Wilson? I don't think so. And he stood there and chose. And it wasn't necessarily the blazing right thing to do. The right thing to do was get me out of this god-awful day. Let me have a drink. And he walked to the telephone. And you and I are here in San Antonio because of that. And all those thoughts went through my mind. And I said to the young priest, no, please don't dip the host in the wine. I just want the wafer, please. And he was very confused. His thing was already up. And Sister Monica took it, and I just took the dry host. And he went around the side of the bed. And I was standing there feeling awkward and shaken. And like, oh God, I've interrupted Mother's devotions. And it's, once again, it's all about me and my bloody alcoholism. And Mother's hand came across the covers. And she took my hand and she pulled me down to her and she whispered, well done. You must continue to protect your precious gift. And I, ladies and gentlemen, fellow members on the journey, want to leave you with that. And I want to leave myself with that. With that constant reminder that I have a precious, precious gift. And, you know, if the Metropolitan Museum of Art were to call me and ask me to take care of a Van Gogh or a Matisse or something, would I hang it in the bathroom? Would I shove it behind the sofa? No, I'd put it in the best place in my home and I'd invite my friends over to see it because I'd know that it had to be passed on. It was not mine forever. And how much more is this than a work of art? So I want to thank you all for being here. I want to thank you for having me on this panel. I want to thank you for going to meetings, for being my friends, for doing service, for putting money in the basket, for doing all that you do. Because if you weren't here, I'd have nowhere to go. So thank you deeply for your sobriety. Thank you.
Very much. That's something we can all take home with us. Our next speaker is Connie Gert. Please help me introduce her.
See if I can get this microphone high enough. My name is Connie and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so I got to tell you, the first thing is my ego is going, wait a minute, my story's exactly the opposite of hers. I didn't go to no London, no art, no New York, no nothing. But I absolutely loved your story and what you talked about. Let me tell you, my home group is Southport Serenity in West Sacramento, California. Yeah! We meet once a week in a little church on Friday nights, and we have a really good meeting, and I hope that if you're in West Sacramento, you come there. And if you're not from California and you go, oh, California speakers, you know, that's not me. I'm not in the Clancy Pacific Negro. You know, we're Northern California. We're just little homegrown kids. And I actually grew up in the town of Davis, and the only reason you might have heard of Davis is because of the University of California there. And that was part of my problem. Because every other kid in school with me seemed like they were the kid of a university professor, and I was not. And so I felt different. I felt less than. I felt left out. My life was just awful. And that was my perspective as a kid. And I've heard a person talk who says, there was my childhood, and then there was what I thought happened in my childhood. And that's what I thought happened in my childhood, was that it was so awful and I was so maligned and my father was an alcoholic and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, interestingly, I've been on Facebook with some people that I've gone to school with. And this one woman says to me, and we were in grade school together, And she's talking, and we both identified the school bully, so I'm pretty sure that was a right fact, because we both had the same guy. But she says she was always the last one picked when we were going to play kickball or baseball. I'm going, wait a minute, that was me. That was me. I know that was me. And later in sobriety, I also met a woman that I was friends with in elementary school, and she says to me, we were best friends, and then I don't know what happened. And I'm going, we were never best friends. See, my perspective and someone else's perspective was totally different. I focused on the negative. When I found alcohol, it fixed me. When I found alcohol, it was a solution. It made my life better. It made my life really good for a little while, a really little while. When I turned 21 years old, I quit drinking in bars 2 months after I turned 21. And I did that because if I drank in bars, I ended up with people I didn't want to end up with, in places I didn't want to be, and I decided that bars were the problem. It wasn't the drinking. Believe me, it wasn't the drinking. It wasn't what the booze did to me. It was the bars. You know. So what I did was drink at home. And I lived with a bunch of college students. And I found myself hiding booze from people who drank like I did. And I didn't recognize it at the time. But when I got sober, I did recognize it. I actually went to the University of California in Davis, and after 5 years, they called me into the dean's office and suggested that I might like to make up all of the incompletes that I had. And my response to that was to walk away. And that was what I always did. I walked away. When I got in any hard situation, did you know you can do geographics in a little town of, you know, it was maybe 35,000 people then? I must have lived in 15 places in that town. Because every time I had a disagreement with a roommate, every time I did something stupid when I was drunk, every time I had a blackout and had some, you know, horrible blow up, my response to that was to just pick up and move. I never worked those situations out, you know. Some of them I don't even remember the people I was living with. But I never worked them out. I just always picked up and ran away. So when they called me into the dean's office, and the reason they had to do that was because my drinking was so bad, it impaired my ability to read and retain information. So I could read the words, but I couldn't tell you what they said. Not 5 minutes later, and certainly not on an exam at the end of the quarter. And so I took all those incompletes, they hospitalized me for depression, and they asked me how much I drank. And I said, you guys can fill in the blank, but only a couple a day, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was a couple of six-packs a day. And so what I did was I went off and I got the only job that I thought anybody would hire me for. I'm 25 years old. I've walked away from my education. I'm living in a rented room in someone else's house. So I'm paying $50 a month for a room to live in. I'm riding a bicycle. Now, a lot of people in Davis ride bicycles. But the reason I'm riding a bicycle is because I had a car, and the car needed a brake job, and I needed to choose between drinking and the brake job. I chose drinking, and I parked the car, and I walked away from it, and I never drove it again. Gone. And so I rode a bicycle. It also probably saved me from the drunk driving tickets. So I rode a bicycle, and I lived in a room in somebody else's house, and I got a babysitting job. And there's nothing wrong with doing childcare, but I got that job because I figured I didn't have to go on a real interview, and no one would hire me to do anything. And that was how I felt about myself when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also was not raised in a faith, and I'm not sure that my mother believed in God. And I had dabbled with trying to find some kind of solution. Even when I was a child, you know, went to church with some friends and came home one day and told my dad, I want to be Catholic. And he said, okay, when you're older, you can make that decision. If you want to go to church with your friends now, that's fine. But I was looking for something to fix me. But I could never find the thing that did until I found alcohol. When I was 25, and hanging out in that babysitting job, having walked away from school, I had a thing that happened where a woman that I knew who had known me a long time, she asked me to do some babysitting for her friends who were from out of town, and they were going to take me over to the motel. And I had a nasty little habit. I would go through other people's medicine chests. And I, of course, did not go sober to this babysitting job. And while I was there, I got some medication, and I incorrectly read the label and judged what it would do to me. And I got somebody's heart medication. And by the time they came back, I could not tell them where I lived or what my name was or anything else. And the next day, and those children were safe and nothing happened to them, thank God. But the next day, that woman came over, and she said, I know what's wrong with you. You're an alcoholic. And I, of course, had every excuse in the book why I was not an alcoholic, and it was, oh, it was this medication I had to take, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I thought, maybe she's right. Because by this time, I'd started to try and control my drinking. I blacked out every time I drank hard liquor. And at one point, I was a fifth-a-day scotch drinker. And so I was trying to control it by only drinking wine and beer because I didn't black out when I did that. And so she gave me the name of a man in our town, and she probably shouldn't have done this, but she did, who was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a doctor in a free clinic. And I contacted him, and he dutifully got a lady to come with him. And they came and they picked me up to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'm like a leftover hippie, you guys. I haven't cut my hair in, you know, 10 years, not because it was cool. I was afraid to go to a beauty shop because I thought people would laugh at me. I wore nothing but blue jeans with holes in them and big baggy blue sweatshirts. And I wanted to be invisible to you and the world. And so he comes, he's a doctor, And they're in her Cadillac because she lives out at the country club. And they pick me up, and I feel so different. And they take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? I went in there looking for the differences. And I found them. I found that you were all old, because I was 25 years old, and you were all at least 50. And I apologize now deeply. Now that I'm 60, I apologize deeply for this opinion. And I also saw the window shades on the wall with God. And I went, I just can't believe in God. I do not believe in God. I'm not an atheist, but I just don't know if there's a God. I can't feel God. And I came in with a prejudice, actually, against churchiness. And so all these ladies are hugging each other, and I equated that with churchiness as well. And I couldn't believe that they could really be that happy, because I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And so that was my inspection tour of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to two or three meetings. I took some pamphlets home. I read them over a nice glass of wine. And it didn't work. Lo and behold. And so I drank for 2.5 more years, and then I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not surrender easily. Some people have stories where they say, I just came in and I just got it. And I was not that person. I came in and I gave you my drinking. That was all I gave you. I gave you my drinking, and that does not work. And I said, okay, I'm going to work those steps that are psychologically and sociologically sound, which meant the ones without God in them. And what I want to tell you is that that does not work. Okay? And I did not stay sober doing that. But fortunately for me, there were a couple of old guys in the group. And one of them would talk about God as good orderly direction. And the other one would talk about God as a group of drunks. And they said to me, you can use AA as your higher power, because you're able to not drink while you're sitting here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you could not do that. And they were right that I couldn't do that. I had an inflamed stomach lining from drinking alcohol, alcoholic gastritis. I tried to quit drinking on my own before I came back that second time, and I could not do it. And so I could say that I was powerless over alcohol, but I wasn't really willing to say that my life was unmanageable, and I wasn't really willing to give myself to a power greater than myself. When I did get sober and I changed my sobriety date, I listened to a woman. She had a couple of years, and I thought she had been sober forever. And her name was Ginger. And she talked about being disturbed, about having a really awful night. And she called someone, and they said to her, Ginger, maybe you should pray. And she had the same kind of lack of belief in a power greater than herself than I did. And she said, you know what, I was so desperate that I was willing to do that. And so she went in her apartment where she lived alone, locked the door, pulled the shades. She said this, locked the door, pulled the shades, and got down on her knees and prayed. And she didn't know what she was praying to, but she prayed and it worked. She got relief. And I listened to that and I thought, you know, I could probably do that if she could do that. And so when I was disturbed, I prayed. And what I did was I prayed to a God I didn't believe in. I prayed to something I didn't know what it was, and it worked. And what I believe in is a higher power that works even if we don't know what it is. I don't have to define it. I love the fact in the big book that Bill has something like 48 terms for a higher power. He has higher power. He has the great reality deep within. He has the sunlight of the Spirit. He has Father of the Universe. He has, you know, Spirit of the Universe. There are a number of terms for a higher power. And I have to be careful because I've learned to use the code word God for my higher power today. But I want to be sure that I keep the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous wide open to people who come in like me who are not quite sure that they can believe in a higher power and that have an old idea about churchiness and who have spirituality confused with that. And you know, that was enough of a higher power for me for quite a while. I did the steps to the very best of my ability, and it kept me sober. And I sponsored women, and I did service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did service at my intergroup. But I want to tell you that at 10 or 11 years sober, I had very little emotional sobriety. My husband and I were living in a house, and we had an argument, and middle of the argument, he's sitting in a room. I walk out to the kitchen, pick up an orange, walk back to the room where he is, and throw it at him because I am so angry at him and I'm not controlling my anger. And you know, that's what you really want, you know, your AA police or whatever that is to come see how it looks in your house. Live in your program at, you know, 10, 11 years sober. And it was shortly after that I got it. I started to do some walking meditation, meditating on the third step prayer. And I got it that I had to bring that higher power into every aspect of my life. That it had to be in my marriage. It had to be in my checkbook. It had to be on my tax forms. It had to be at my work. It had to be on the freeway. Oh, that's a hard one. On the freeway. Scott L. from Tennessee says, now when he drives on the freeway, he waves at people with his whole hand. And I just love that. Because I try and give people a pass. I try to cut them some slack. Then I went to the San Diego International, which was a fabulous experience for me. I got sober in 1979, and San Diego was the first international that I was able to go to. And I was absolutely on fire when I left that. And a woman handed me a flyer for the International Alcoholics Anonymous Women's Conference, and it's now just called the International Women's Conference. And they're having fun. And I went to that, and it's a great thing to do. If you sober women have never gone, it's one of the best-kept secrets in AA. It's every year, and it's in a different location, and it is a barrel of fun, 3,000 to 5,000 women every year. At any rate, I bought a set of tapes from a guy named Bob B. out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I listened to those, and he talked about living in long-term sobriety with the steps and what we do about that. And he said he looked at himself and he said, if I say that a higher power and Alcoholics Anonymous are my priority, and I had done that, I had sat down and looked at my priorities, and I said that a higher power and AA came before my family and that came before work. And those were my priorities for my life. And he said, if that's my priority, how much time do I spend seeking God? How much effort do I put forth? How much reading do I do, maybe outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, to enhance my spiritual growth? And the answer for me at that time was just about none. And I did a lot of work in AA. I went to meetings, I did service, but I didn't do much of that other stuff. And I decided that I needed to do that. And I started to read, and I started to meditate, and I started to pray more. And I started to look for a church, and I found a church that would work for me where they celebrate all paths to God. And I thought, that sounds pretty familiar. Maybe I could do this. And we'll even sometimes call God a higher power in that church. And I realized that I really wanted some spiritual growth. And I took a meditation class at that church. And I was also going through the steps again with a new sponsor. And I was doing a lot of prayer. And I had a spiritual awakening at 21 years sober that was unlike others that I'd had. And it was only after I had it. And I'll tell you what I found. I found that place deep down inside that is the same spirit that I had when I came into the world before anything bad happened. And what I know is that I am connected to all of you with that same spirit. And if I recognize that, I have to treat you differently. And I have to realize that the people in my life are doing the best they can with the consciousness that they have at the time. And if they knew better, they'd do better. And if I'm willing to give you that slack, I might be willing to give me that slack too. And, after that, I reread a New Pair of Glasses by Chuck Fee. And in it, he talks about God as me, through me, in me. And the fact that I cannot be separate from that higher power. Even if I don't know what it is, even if I don't have a name for it other than higher power, I cannot be separate from it. If that is all there is, then I cannot be separate from it. And it was after that that I noticed this little phrase in step 11 that I had probably read a million times. You know how they keep inserting those new things in your book? The book fairies came along, inserted this in my book. It said, there is a direct linkage among self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit. But when they are logically related and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. And that was what I had been doing. I had been meditating faithfully because I was taking that class. I had been doing prayer, and I had been doing self-examination because I had been going through these steps again. And I have learned that I have to keep growing in this program. I cannot stop and say, this is enough. Let me tell you that I am 30 years sober, but I don't know that what I'm doing right now, and I borrowed this line from my friend Ron, is enough to keep me 31 years sober or to get me to 32 years sober. And I need to continue to grow. I start study groups and have study groups in my home. And we read other spiritual material and we talk about how it relates to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, how we bring it back into that framework in our lives. Because sometimes if I can hear something in a different way, it makes more sense to me. We're still talking about the principles. They're spiritual principles. So they're the same principles that we read about and that we use in AA. I wrestled with the idea of God's will, and I found this in the third step. Again, another one of those things inserted in my book when I was about 20 years sober. And it says, all of the 12 steps require sustained and personal exertion. By the way, I hate that when I find those words that mean work. All of the 12 steps require sustained and personal exertion to conform to their principles, and so we trust to God's will. And that totally simplified it for me. Because if God's will is doing these principles, you know, I can sit down, I can read my 12 and 12, I can read the big book, I can figure out what the principles of the program are. I don't need a list given to me by somebody else, thank you very much. I can use that list, but that's not the end-all be-all. And I can figure out what the principles are, and if I can live those as my life, I have a pretty comfortable life with a higher power in it. And that's you know, that for me is part of asking for the guidance to do what the next right thing is. I don't know what the next right thing is, but I can ask for guidance for the right action. And in the beginning of the 12 and 12, it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And happily and usefully whole is what I wanted. That's why I drank. I was trying to fill that God-shaped hole in my gut, that spiritual place. And I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got it by living those principles. I have one little comment to share. I don't know if any of you have been in the restrooms up here, but I love it. They have little levers that go up and down, up for number one, down for number two. They're very ecologically sound. And one of my amends that I have to make, you know, I made the living amends to the family, and I made the direct amends, and I made the financial amends. But one of the amends I have to make is when I was drunk, I went fishing with my best friend and her boyfriend. And of course, the cooler full of beer was the absolutely most important thing we took. Fishing rods were extra, you know, really optional. And we threw our beer cans in the Sacramento River. And that is totally against my ethics. But when I'm drunk, my ethics go out the window. So one of the things that I have to do to make amends for forevermore is cleaning up after myself, recycling, picking up garbage I didn't throw on the ground. And so I was just really glad to see the little up lever, down lever, because that's helping me with my amends. And I want to thank you very much for letting me share.
Anybody else, but I feel like I'm about 2 feet off the ground right now. Ooh, it's really strong in here tonight. Okay, well, our last speaker is Dick Hedger. Help me welcome him, please.
Thanks, Debbie. I'm Dick Hedger. I'm an alcoholic. In keeping with Texas traditions, my sobriety date is November 20th, 1983. My home group is the Big A Group in Alexandria, Kentucky. And a few of us out there. I've got a sponsor. He's here. His name's Dune. And I sponsor people, and a couple of them are here. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife, she said, why did they ask you to talk? Yeah. And I said, because I'm very wise. And yeah, she laughed, too. And I am. What happened was I got a phone call one day. So a guy in a halfway house at Charlie's Three Quarters House in Cincinnati. And he said, I heard you're a very wise man. And I just started laughing. I was laying in bed with an ice pack on my neck and a heating pad on my back. I had had about five surgeries. Is this thing on? I had had about five surgeries. And we were moving an office out of a room and down, you know, down. And I couldn't walk up and down steps. And I couldn't walk up and down steps, but I wanted to help my wife. So, you know, I'm carrying things down the driveway going down the side of the house. I'm carrying things down the driveway, and I had one last item to get down there. It was an office chair. I got at the top of the driveway, so there's no need to carry it. So I sat on it and rode it down the driveway. I hit the bottom of the driveway, hit the grass, took about 10 somersaults, you know, wound up over the hill. I got up real quick, made sure none of the neighbors saw me, you know. And this guy's just telling me I'm a very wise man, you know. So that takes care of that myth. You know, when we were asked to do something like this, I looked in the book for freedom to choose. There's nothing in there really about freedom to choose. There's freedom and choices. But there was an article way back in the grapevine written by Bill Wilson. It's called Freedom to Choose. Looking back, we see that our freedom to choose badly was not, after all, very real freedom. When we chose because we must, this was not a real choice either. But it got us started in the right direction. When we chose because we ought to, we were really doing better. This time, we were earning some freedom, making ourselves ready for more. But when now and then we could gladly make right choices without rebellion, holdout, or conflict, then we had our first view of what perfect freedom under God's will could be like. And that meant a lot to me. I started drinking when I was only 13 years old. That's old by today's standard. By the time I was 16 years old, I just got out of high school, and I was a raging alcoholic. What I did is I ran away to the seminary. I joined the priesthood. I thought that would cure my alcoholism. Didn't know what it was called. I was in a seminary, but every time they let me out for a little weekend, I'd come back drunk. Got reported to the bishop, and about several times later, about a year later, the bishop's waiting for me. He got tired of hearing it. One thing led to another. I'm drunk, and I took a drunken swing at the bishop. Now, narrow-minded as they were, they threw me out of the seminary. A year later, I'm working at General Electric. After work, I'd go to a CD bar. Newport, Kentucky was called Sin City at that time. And that's near where I lived. And, I mean, this was prostitution and gambling, wide open. In the West End of Newport was bad. There was a place over there called Butters, one of the nastiest bars in the world. It really only had one saving grace, really one good point in the whole bar. They had a topless blackjack dealer in the back room. Really two good points now I'm thinking about it. I'm in there drunk. I'm 18 years old. I'm a little guy. I only weighed like 145 pounds. And by this time, I could drink a lot of whiskey. I had an ungodly capacity for bourbon whiskey. I was drunk, and somebody bet me I couldn't chug like a quart of whiskey. And I did. And I was in an alcoholic coma for 5 days, hospitalized almost a year. It took about a year and a half of my life to recover. I mean, I was really almost brain dead. Couldn't see for a while, couldn't read for a while, couldn't think, still can't think very well. But I recovered from that, and I was properly horrified. So I had the freedom again to choose, because during that time I didn't have the freedom. Alcohol was making my choices for me. And after that, I had the freedom to choose again, because I was afraid. I knew what alcohol would do to me, so I didn't drink for a long time. As a result of that, I was able to get a college degree. I got married. I got a sweetheart. All those kind of things. And got a good job. I was working for an insurance company. And I was going to night law school to further my career. And I was half a year away from my law degree. And I started drinking again. And I lost that freedom. I don't guess I have to tell you the rest of that story, do I? I ain't a lawyer. I never went back. And I got into the... I was a claims manager for a major insurance company. Blew a big case, and they were ready to fire me. Picked up a newspaper. If you had a college degree back then, you'd get a job anywhere. And I picked up a newspaper and said, wanted, pharmaceutical salesman. I said, I bet I could sell drugs. So went off my career as a drug dealer. I got into the pharmaceutical business, sold little drugs like Percodan and, you know, stuff. Some of you may have heard of that. And I guess the miracle of all that, I never took drugs in my life. I was afraid to death of drugs. We used to sample them out of the trunk of our car. I mean, they were just, if I wanted Quaaludes, I could get 100 of them from my next buddy, you know, that kind of thing. So we were, you know, thank God I never took drugs. Yeah, there's something wrong with this. You have to hold it, they said. Thank you. Yeah, there we go. So I never took drugs in my life, and that was a real miracle. I'm working for this pharmaceutical company. I'm doing very, very well because I was watching my drinking for a lot of years. I was in and out of controlled drinking. There's a line in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that it's a great obsession of every alcoholic to both be able to enjoy and control his drinking. When I'm enjoying it, and I'm not controlling it, you know, vice versa. And I did well in the business, but they were starting to notice my alcoholism. I was at a national sales meeting being honored as a regional director of the year, and I passed out off the stage right into my vice president's lap. Another time I was in Texas, and I was being considered for another position because I was watching my drinking again. And I wasn't going to drink at this meeting because there were three of us for this big position, and I wasn't going to drink. But they were having a card game, and I had one drink, and, you know, about 47 drinks later, I'm in one of these big hotels. I can't find my room. I got a key in my hand. And a German fellow came up to me in his guttural language. I'll come, I help you. And let's get out of here, you effing trout. Never did like you damn Germans anyway. Forgot to tell you, I worked for a German pharmaceutical company. International sales manager of the German pharmaceutical company. He said, put him on a plane back to Cincinnati and fire him. Well, guy took a chance on me back in Cincinnati, and I was able to retire from that company, believe it or not. But anyway, that's how my drinking was. But what happened? Somewhere along the line, my wife of many, many years started drinking. I couldn't see it. I was so into me that I couldn't see my wife had a problem. But it got to the point, I told her, you need to do something about your drinking. You know, if you can't drink responsibly like me, you know, you shouldn't drink. And I came over at work one day, it was May 1983, and she said, I saw something on TV about a care unit, and I want to go down there. It was about 30 minutes from her house. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she wanted to look good when she got to that care unit. So she, you know, she washed her hair, put up her hair up 37 times, you know, washed all her clothes, ironed all her clothes, and drank coffee all day. I had to have something to do, so I drank a quart of whiskey. Well, we get down to the care unit, it was 11 o'clock that night, and they had a dilemma on their hands because I'm drunk and she's sober. You know, which one do you keep? I'm a salesman, you know. She stayed and I left. On the way home, I'd stop at my bar, have a drink, and all my buddies would say, "What a bad deal. It has a drunk for a wife, Dick. Give Dick a drink." And I'd come staggering home, you know, about three. My kids, right? Three kids by now. They're hiding in the closet or under the bed. Their mommy's in the hospital. Their big shot dad's out getting pats on the back for having a drunken wife. And that's hard to get over, guilt like that. But see, that's alcoholism. She got out. I couldn't stay sober. She couldn't stay sober. In November of that year, she said, "Ask me if I do something about my drinking." It was November 19th. She said, "Maybe if you'd quit bringing whiskey home, maybe I'd have a chance." So I promised her I'd do something. And the next morning I got up. I looked in the mirror. I weighed like 245 pounds. And I had long, unkempt hair. My clothes were a mess because I'm only making a fraction of what I used to make because I kept getting demotion after demotion after demotion, you know, because I chose to drink. And I looked in the mirror and I said, "You know, that's not your problem. Dick, I remembered something, but drinking's not your problem. Your problem is you're not making enough money. You're not making enough money. You're a salesman. You can make all the money you want, but look at you. You're a fat slob. Go on a diet. You know, get a haircut. You know, go off and buy some new clothes." Went downtown Cincinnati. A guy, is Tony here? A guy named Tony taps me on the shoulder. A coincidence. Tony and I were friends. We were in the same business together. Tony had been sober 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm looking for a cheap sport coat. And Tony had given a lead at my wife's very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And he asked me how things were going. I started telling him about my drunken wife. Well, he talked me into going to 405 Oak Street night, beginner's club. 405 Oak Street is the oldest clubhouse in the United States. In fact, next weekend we're celebrating our 65th anniversary there at 405 Oak Street. I went to beginner's class, and I haven't had a drink since. You'll have to go there, Lauren. Thank you for talking. When we get there, it's really a neat old clubhouse. The same old building. It's an old mansion. It's kind of neat. But anyway, I went to that meeting. I haven't had a drink since. Now, the first 6 months in AA, I just lived at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. That's all I was doing. I wasn't doing anything else. And I'm going to tell you something. I was miserable. I wanted to drink every minute I was alive. But eventually, I went to my sponsor and said, "I can't live like this." And he said, "Dick, you know, the person you used to be is going to drink again." He says, "If you choose to keep doing what you do, you're going to drink again." So I chose to follow his example, and I chose to follow the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result, I haven't had a drink since, and I've been a lot more happy. Life went on. You know, as life went on, things weren't always good in my sobriety. I had a period of several months where everything that could go wrong seemed to go wrong all at once. I was in a really bad car wreck. As a result of that, I've had 13 major surgeries. You'll see, my wife's got my cane out there. I gimp around pretty good. I was in my son broke his neck diving into a pool with no water in it, drunk. I had a daughter with an abusive marriage. Had a baby born with cerebral palsy who will never walk. And my wife had been sober a couple of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, started drinking again. And I was crushed. I was out of town. I was trying to work. I hadn't had the first major back surgery yet. Trying to work the best I could, and I was taking a shower. Much like Job in the Bible, I'm cussing God, saying, "My God, look what you're doing to me. I'm trying to stay sober, ain't much, but I'm better than I used to be." And he said, "Look what you're doing to me." And I started reciting all this stuff out. And I came out to brush my hair. The mirror fogged up. I said across the mirror, "I love you." My dirty mind said, "Wow, somebody had a heck of a night here." But the second line fogged up and said, "I love you, God." You know, I know some little fervent kid did that on the mirror. I know some maid didn't do her job, but I know it was there for me to see when I needed to see it. And I came back, and I had a new resolve. I had all these surgeries and reasonably recovered. My son had 8 hours of neurosurgery. He's not paralyzed. Matter of fact, he's a union plumber today by trade. My daughter got rid of that abusive husband, married another jerk. I'm not even going to go there. My daughter had two little boys by the second marriage, and my little grandbaby was kind of a little odd girl left out, and the state came in and took my granddaughter away from my wife. In the meantime, I'd gotten remarried. I'll talk about that later. But I had gotten remarried, and my wife and I took my granddaughter in. And she lived with us for about a year, and she could not walk, but she can fly on her little walker. You know, she's 18 years old today, but she could fly on her little walker, but her little hips went out on her. We had to take her to the hospital, and they broke her hips, put her in a full body cast, and I visit her every night. She calls me Poppy. She wanted a buck for something. It got up to $10. I said, "Honey, what do you need all that for?" She said, "Oh, soft drinks and candy." I said, $10? She says, "Oh, I got plenty, but none of them do." She was in a wheelchair going around Children's Hospital in Cincinnati buying other little kids soft drinks and candy. Now, where does that come from? Got to be a God thing, despite her stuff in life. She's back with her mother. She got married last year. We thought that's the worst thing could ever happen to this little girl. She got married to a guy that's kind of slow, and we set her up in an apartment, and a week after that, he walks out on her. And we're thinking, "Oh, my God, how bad can it be?" You know, But it turned out the best thing that ever happened to us. She got independent. She went back to school. She's working on her college degree now. She's living all alone in her own apartment, and she's become a little lady. And it's amazing what God's plan is today. You know, I got through all this. My wife never stopped drinking. It got really bad. As a result of that, we separated. She put her in a separate apartment, and my daughter was checking her one day and found her dead on the couch. She was 54 years old and actually drank herself to death. I want to tell you something about my wife. She was a wonderful woman, a great mother to my kids. I was a rotten father. A great wife to me until she got in the clutches of alcoholism and just couldn't get out. I was going to Al-Anon through all this. I promised to save her a couple minutes. I was going to Al-Anon through all this, and a lady kind of liked my legs, and I kind of liked her country accent, and there she sits. Her name's Marlene. She's a very active member of Al-Anon, and we are just truly in love together. We talk at several conventions together. It's kind of neat. Kind of neat fun on ladies. You know, I get always left whatever time's left. Same way with Marlene talks. <You know? laughs> So we've been married now almost 16 years coming up. And it's really a neat relationship. She's the lady that took my grandbaby. That's not her grandma. That's my granddaughter. And she took her in for a year. And this kind of lady she is. Wonderful, wonderful lady. What's it like today? You know, pretty good. Life's pretty good. I retired from my company, and I wanted to see the world when I retired, and because the company treated me very, very well, but my wife wanted a dog. I didn't want a dog, but she wanted a dog. But she came home with a dog anyway, a little tiny Pomeranian. And this Pomeranian didn't have a thing to do with my wife. It fell in love with me, and I fell in love with little Patty. But Patty didn't last very long. Patty was her liver didn't grow. She was several months old. I was taking Cliff Roche back to the airport from a convention. Some of you remember Cliff Roche or know Cliff Roche. And I got a cell phone call, and my little dog had died, and I was crushed. And I told my wife, don't ever bring another dog into my house. She didn't care. She went down to the country and got Patty's brother, who was a relative at bottom. His name was Jackie, and brought him home anyway. And Jackie fell in love with me. It didn't have nothing to do with my wife. So she goes out and wants her own dog. So she goes to the pet store and gets this little thing. I don't know what it is. Half Chihuahua, half something. It's a little dog, and we start noticing something's wrong with this little dog. It walks in circles. It cannot walk a straight line. It cannot turn right. It cannot walk. From here to there, it'll make about 20 turns. And the dog has no control over anything. It has to wear diapers. And they said it might live a week. I said, go get your money back. No, that's my dog, she said. Dog's 8 years old today. And still walks in circles, still has a diaper. We still got the other dog. Now, you can't leave a dog like this in a dog place, you know. So her solution is get a motorhome. So we get this big 40-foot motorhome, you know, the kind you drive. I am terrified of this motorhome. It literally scared the crap out of me. I got diarrhea every time I drove it. Anyway, go down the highway, you got, you know, barriers here and big trucks over there, you know, you're like this. And now, it didn't bother my wife to drive the motorhome. I mean, she don't even drive it. She's got 3 DUIs and she don't drink. That's how bad she drives. I mean, she got picked up for 3 DUIs. I mean, she drives like this. And she thought she could drive the motorhome well, but it scared me worse than when I drove it. So I told you about the driveway going down the side of our house. Well, we got this driveway, and I got to get over this fear. And if you got a motorhome, you can't parallel park, and you got to haul something. We had a Jeep. So I said, you follow me over to the place. It's about 20 miles from our house. And you follow me in the Jeep. And I start, you know, and we'll go over there. I got to get over the fear of this motorhome. So I start up this big driveway. She starts to follow me. And she said, stop the home. Honey, what's wrong? She looked. I said, didn't hit nothing. Forgot to unplug it. They got a big power cord on them, you know. And I said, that's good. I noticed the cord was broke. We're going to the motorhome joint. We'll get a new power cord. Can they put the deck back on the house? She had wrapped the pole around the thing. The deck had fallen on her, on the car, on, you know. And another time I'm driving the motorhome, and I sideswiped the house, ripped the side of the motorhome out. Another time forgot to unlock the Jeep's wheels, and down in Louisville, Kentucky, burned the tires off the Jeep. A couple years ago, sold the motorhome, only lost $10,000, the happiest day of my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell a little quick story, and then I'm going to close and give our chair lady a couple minutes. Story of the Prodigal Son. You all know that story? Kind of an updated version. I heard something like, and I made it up to suit Alcoholics Anonymous. About a young fellow. Went to his dad when he was 17 years old. He said, I want my inheritance, Dad. I want to see the world. His dad was a millionaire. He was an only child. Lived in a mansion, you know, with the Rolls Royces and the Rembrandts and the Picassos. His dad gave him his millions. He went off and ripped and roared through the world. He was one of us. absolutely one of us. He blew all his money by the time he was 25, and he was a drunk. But he found his way to Alcoholics Anonymous. When he was a year sober, his sponsor gave him a coin like we do, and he gave him a little plaque with the 12 steps, or a little wooden plaque with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he treasured this. But the young fellow got a disease and was dying. And his sponsor said, "You need to go home, Johnny, to your daddy for the last few days." He said, "I haven't talked to my dad in 15 years. I took the money and ran. I haven't seen him in almost 15 years. I haven't even called him." He said, "No, you go home. Your daddy will accept you. Daddies are like that." After a lot of prodding, he went on home. He went up this big tree-lined driveway. Here comes the old man down. "Don, you're home. My son, you're home. Come in the house. Take your possessions. Put him anywhere you want." He said, "Daddy, I don't have any possessions. All I got, I became a drunk. I lost all my money. All I have is this coin to show I'm a year sober. And I got this little plaque with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on it." And the old man took that plaque and hung it over the fireplace. Pulled a Rembrandt off the wall. It stayed there, but the young fellow died. Shortly after that, the old man was grief-stricken. He died, too. But they had an auction to auction off all the property because there was nobody in the family. And they were auctioning off the Rolls Royces and the Bentleys and the Rembrandts and all the other stuff. And the auctioneer, literally thousands of people showed up on this big tree-lined driveway. And the auctioneer held up this little plaque with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the young fellow sponsor was there just for the heck of it, you know. And he held up this plaque in it of the 12 steps. He said, "What am I bid for whatever this is?" And nobody said a word. But finally, the young fellow sponsor said, "Well, I'll give you $5 for it." And the auctioneer said, "Sold." In fact, the auction's over. It's the terms of the will. Whoever gets the 12 steps gets it all. I'm Dick Hedger. I'm an alcoholic.